is so unique. Oh, the one thing I didn't finish that I do want to say, because this is very important, is that what I've never died in this life. I don't, you know, I have not had that experience. I haven't had an outer body experience. I've had beautiful experiences in meditation, but nothing like what we're talking about. And I know now that a couple of you have, but probably not everybody. So most of what I will talk about has to do with what I've learned from these masters, through these masters, and then through Swami Kriyananda, people who have given me enough experiences, like these experiences that I'm sharing with you, like a stranger walking up in a bookstore and saying, go to East West Bookstore. You know, it's, I mean, if Master himself had taken a body again, taken my arm and said, come here, Shanti, I'm going to walk you up to Stanford, then I'm going to introduce you to East West, then you'll get to know all about me. It couldn't have been any more real or perfect. It was just like being picked up and being put everywhere. Well, you know, you have enough of those experiences. And you hear, like, the story I told you about the English barrister. And they just go on. And I'll tell you more tonight. Till soon you get, this is the truth. Everything they're telling us is the truth. They know it. They've seen it. They've lived it. And they're sharing it with us. And then, of course, we develop our own intuition. All of us. We begin to see these things happen. So we're not just reading a book that they wrote or listening to a talk that Swamiji gave. That's how it starts for us. But soon we begin to know something really beyond a doubt. These are truths because it's just manifested itself in my life in enough ways. Okay? What this class has to be about is totally from the soul's perspective. The class can't make any sense. The whole notion of death, dying, karma, reincarnation, you can't even speak about it from the ego's perspective, other than part of what Connie was saying earlier when she says somebody dies in your life. The truth is you have a hole in your life. That was a hole that only they could fill for a while. When your mother leaves, she leaves. When your son leaves, he leaves. Even if he comes back and your neighbor's baby again, still, that doesn't give you back. So we're not denying the human experience here, but we want to hold this up and say, how can we look at this whole experience now from the soul's perspective? So that, you know, when we do some of our celebrations here, we celebrate Master's Mahasamadhi when he left his body. Now we celebrate Swamiji's moksha when he left his body. And we come in and we greet each other or their birthdays or whatever, and we're saying happy birthday or happy moksha day or happy Mahasamadhi. We're happy. We're actually in an uplifted state. And when you look around the church and you see people who aren't used to being here, and they're sort of, why are people celebrating? Why are people feeling so good about something that so many people feel so terrible about? So as we look at this as this soul attaining freedom, I mean real freedom, not being caught, even with Master, even a true avatar, no karma to live out anymore. But what did he say? He said he remembers when he was born in this life. He said it was like putting on a heavy winter coat on a hot summer day, having to squeeze that consciousness into that body. So he's having, God himself only knows what experience he's having. But once he takes on this human life, he still has to live within some of the confines of it. I shouldn't even say that because, you know, we know all these saints who don't eat, who don't drink, who stay in the Himalayas over all the winter with no protection around them. So he didn't have to, but he chose to in this life live in terms of his body. And Swami Kriyananda, who was Master, told him, you'll be completely free at the end of this life. At death, you will know freedom. Still, he had to live in terms of being a human being. So these things happen, But what we're interested in is what's going on with the soul. What's happening from a soul perspective with all of, as we talk about death and dying. So let me just say, just trying to think of where to pick this up and not steal Bhajana's thunder for next week. But we all know, and we said again earlier, that the soul is on a journey, that the soul is some small spark of this infinite consciousness, and it's on a journey, and it's on a journey back to realizing its true, free, infinite nature. That's what's happening. But it needs this body. It needs this body purely as a vehicle to get from here to there. Last week in our retreat, it came to me and I said, you know, if you're hitchhiking from New York City to San Francisco, you can get a ride that takes you 100 miles and drops you off. You can get a ride that takes you 500 miles and drops you off. Or maybe sometimes somebody gets in a car and it drives them all the way across the country. Whatever happens in that ride, in that particular part of the journey, you're making progress. You're moving towards your destination. So our job in this life is just to make as much spiritual progress as we possibly can, really to whatever degree we can, without worrying about how much progress we've made, what we haven't made, what we're stuck on, but just keep putting one proverbial foot in front of the other on this path to keep moving towards soul realization. That's what we're doing. So the soul does that. These bodies don't live forever. The body dies so far, so 180 degrees from what really happens. And then for us here, we have this extraordinary grace of having these masters. So we're not sitting in a synagogue, as I was, with a rabbi who was a very nice man, and he studied hard to learn everything that he had to learn. And then he added in his own interpretation and his own 2 cents worth, and he spoke about that and gave sermons about that or the truth. But it was not perceived reality. It was intellectual knowledge that most of these people were sharing with me, certainly all my life, I mean all that young life, even though I was looking consciously. I wanted something more, and I knew it. But it came to me at a certain time, this isn't it, you know? And then I had to go out on my search. And it probably happened to a lot of people, because it is what goes on with most ministers, priests. It doesn't matter who it is. They are not people who have had an experience of the soul's yearning to be free. They don't talk about death as a freeing of the soul. They talk about death as a horrible end. I mean, most people. So I wanted to share a story when we were talking before about a woman who I knew many years ago, who I took care of in my private medical practice. She came to me one day after she had had this horrible experience. I have to fill you in with the experience first. She was driving one night with her 2 daughters, and they were in a motor vehicle accident. They were hit head-on by somebody who had been drinking. And she was in a coma for weeks. But when she came out of the coma, she was told that her youngest daughter had been killed in that accident. And her other daughter lived through the accident, as did she. And she came in to meet me in my practice, and she just said to me, somebody told me that if I come to see you, you'll help me. And I said to her, well, I'll listen to you. I didn't really know what helping her meant at that point. She was devastated. And she started saying to me, I have to see her. I have to see her, Shanti. And she found a way to get herself into my schedule whenever she wanted to come in and see me. Very busy medical office. But every day I saved some spots for people who were urgently ill. And I'd see her on my schedule. Worst headache of my life. Severe abdominal pain. And I'd know that nothing was wrong with her, but she had figured out the system. And she would come in and she would just want to be there with me. And we just talked. There was nothing to do, but she kept saying she has to come. So each time I would speak to her about the nature of death, that nothing had happened to her daughter, that her daughter was still in a different way as alive as ever, which really meant very little to her. And I wasn't helping her. You know, I really was not giving her any peace of mind. One day she came in to see me. This is about a year and a half later. And she said to me, "You won't believe what happened." She said, she came to me last night, she said. "But if I tell anybody else, they'll think it was a dream." I forget who was talking about saying it wasn't a dream. They know it wasn't a dream. But anyway, we were talking a lot about visitations. And she said to me, "I was in the synagogue, and it was this holiday, Sukkot, which is about the fall harvest. Very festive, fun holiday. Kids run up and down the aisle in the synagogues." And she said suddenly she was running to me. She just ran into my arms and she said to me, "Mom, I can't stay for too long, but I'm here to tell you I'm not suffering. I feel freer than I've ever felt," she said. "And I'm watching you and her sister's name, whatever it is." She said, "I haven't been able to come to you yet. Because you didn't really, you thought you wanted to see me, but you weren't letting me in. But now I could come, and I want you to know I'm perfectly fine." And I said to this woman, interestingly, I mean, of course, I believed her right away completely. But I said to her, "What did your husband say?" She looked at me, she said to me, "Oh, I would never tell my husband or anyone until I told you." She said, "Because they'll tell me it was just a dream." You know, actually, it was very wise, because with all of these teachings, isn't that the truth? You don't want to share them. You want to be very careful where you share these teachings, because as soon as you say them to somebody who can only hear them with mind, they're minimized. And they have to make them make sense to themselves. You know, this is one of the very last stanzas in the Bhagavad Gita. So beautifully, Krishna says this, where he says a number of, this is a summary statement to Arjuna, teaching us. First he says, no matter whatever duty you have, you can always forsake your duty for a higher duty, and I will relieve you of all of the karma that you would have accrued for not following through with whatever you're supposed to follow through with. But then he says, but as I share all of these teachings with you, Krishna says it much more eloquently than I am. He said, never share them with anybody who doesn't believe them or who doesn't hold me, meaning the divine, in the highest regard. It's actually a very important lesson about the stuff we're talking about, again, because so few people know. When you have these experiences, whatever they are, all the experiences we were talking about earlier, they're precious. They're absolutely precious. And again, I don't want to keep saying it, most people don't have these experiences. So they won't know what to do with it. And as we get freer and we have more of them and we much more easily communicate with people, whether they're in their bodies or not, or an experience like Bhajana's sister's having, she can't go to anybody and tell them, "This is my son who's just come back," you know? I mean, there's no way. She has to carry it. She has to just write to Bhajana, who knows and who understands what the truth is, but to hold it in a way so that nobody can minimize it for us, because it changes the experience. It stops the communication. So that woman who said to me, "I would never have told anybody until I told you," she needed to be able to live the truth of it, which is, a really beautiful gift that both she and I were given. This is another interesting story that I wanted to remember to tell because of what Robert was talking about with his grandfather earlier, and I said I would get back to it. There's a story, I don't know this story, but I've heard Asha tell it several times, about a woman, this is a true story, now this woman wrote this book, and who committed suicide. And she left her body, and instead of going, the loca, the next place that she went to, was what a lot of people would refer to as hell. It was very dark, dingy, cold. She said she hated being there. She looked around at other people. Everybody's consciousness was low. People were bent over. She said everybody was only looking down, literally looking down. And she said, suddenly I felt like something was happening above me. And I looked up and I was drawn by this light. And she said, I realized that there were a lot of angels up there, angelic beings, is what she said, who wanted to help me. They wanted to help me get out. And I tried to tell everybody else around me that we could get help. She said, but people, most of the beings down there, the souls, not people, refused to look up. She said, but as long as I was willing to look up and face the light, I was saved, which is another sort of interesting. I wanted to say that because we don't know what happens. I mean, suicide is not a good way out. It doesn't save the soul anything. In fact, Master said you can actually lose spiritual ground and progress. But even in that instance, and she came back and she started writing books and she started lecturing, first of all, about depression and suicide, but also about literally what it meant to look into the light, even as you were dying. So another thing that Swamiji has said about dying is that no matter how we've lived, no matter what progress we've made or haven't made, no matter what our beliefs are, if at that last moment of life, as we're leaving, if we can literally, what she's calling, look into the light, if we can, this is why when Mahatma Gandhi died and the last thing he said was calling to God was so important, because it has everything to do with what happens to the soul from then on. Regardless of how you've lived, of course, most people who haven't lived this way can't remember to do it, so it's a little bit of a trick. That we should really be practicing our whole life living this way is the truth. But no matter what, you know, there was that story that most of you know where I think it was Swamiji or one of the monks who went to see another person who was dying, and Master said, how was it when he passed? And they said to Master, well, he was just laying in bed saying, I'm sorry I didn't do more of this, or I wish I had done more of that, or Master just looked, he said, oh, he shouldn't have done that. You know, with deep empathy and compassion, like to not leave in the moment that we're leaving with regrets or apologies or, again, looking at what happened in this life, but really as much as we can or as much as we can help people when they're passing. When I started in medical school and medical training, I had been a nurse, an ICU nurse for all those years. I was very used to people dying. And for our first year of clinical experience, every time somebody was going to die, the other medical students would come and find me. You know, they were terrified. I mean, because how many of you, by the way, have ever been around when somebody's actually passed? So most of you have, but not everybody. Yeah, it's a powerful experience. It's a very powerful experience, particularly if you're aware and if you're really working with that soul. But like I was talking before about breathlessness and how much the idea of that can scare people, if you've never been there, and particularly if it's not beautiful and easy, for whatever reason, we have no idea what's going on with the soul, but for whatever reason, not every death looks pretty. It just simply doesn't. The medical students would come and get me. Can you come and be with me? You know, their patients were dying. And really, the one thing that I wanted to teach all of them is that if you can be with somebody as they're passing, that moment when the soul's leaving, and have that be all right with you. Assist that soul in going. Give, literally, you could say it out loud. It's okay for you to leave. It's perfectly okay for you to leave. I remember when my stepfather died, I was very, very close with him by the time he died. And he was on the East Coast, and I was flying back and forth every 2 to 4 weeks to spend time with him. So it was a Wednesday morning, and I was supposed to fly again on Friday. And he was in an assisted living place, but he really was not sick. I mean, I wasn't expecting him to die. And I get a phone call about 5 in the morning. And the nurse says, "Is this Dr. Rubenstein?" I said, "Yeah." They said, "We're calling to tell you that your father died." And I said to them, "Are you sure?" I mean, I was so amazed that he left without me. But later, one of his daughters said to me, he looked at me one day and he said, "There's no way I could leave if Shanti's here." I mean, it was just that clear. If I were going to go and visit him, he was not going to be able to leave. So that, again, remembering that we're not just speaking to a human being who's dying, but that we're helping to lift a soul up towards the light to help them go, whatever it is, in his case. And somebody told a story about, I forget who it was now, I keep blocking on her name, Vina? Vina, about her father, who left. She was so surprised that he left, but she sort of felt like he couldn't go if she was there. That's exactly what happened with my father. So as long as we know that all that's happening, again, is the soul is being free, we experience the loss, but they don't. I wanted to read this line to you about another woman who wrote, she had, you know, we call them near-death experiences, but they're not really near-death. They are death. They're like shortened death experiences. I mean, the soul leaves the body, and often there's no heart rate, there's no breath. So it's a weird thing. But anyway, she wrote this book, and she said, "When I left my body, I felt an instant relief, knowing in an instant that everything I had ever wanted was mine right then." That's what she said. "I felt an instant relief." She said, "I felt absolute, unconditional acceptance of every aspect of my being." Isn't that beautiful? I knew in an instant that everything I had ever wanted was mine right then. Just that knowing, not figuring it out. You know, I'm telling you a lot of these stories because it's very nice for us to be able to hear that it's freeing, that it's not all of what we've held it to be, and particularly those of us who have lost people in painful ways, that if we get out of ourselves and we hear, this is another thing about all of these people who are writing about near-death experiences and who can come back and share their experiences, both the lightness of it and the darkness. This woman who literally went to hell, but who said, "Suddenly I realized we can't keep looking down. We have got to look up and into the light." It's so interesting. I talk about death and dying all the time. I talk for hours and hours, and suddenly I'm up here, I'm thinking, do I have anything else to say? Isn't it? It's just the oddest feeling that I'm having. Anybody in this room who knows me, I sort of never run out of words, but I'm just sitting here saying, well, if I don't talk about karma and reincarnation, which most people in this room know about, just in terms of death and dying, I'm really not sure that I have a lot more I want to say tonight. I don't know where that's coming from, but that's where I am, and I'm going to honor it, Suma. There's an essay, I'm trying to think of what book it's in, because it's a book of essays that Swami wrote, and I can't, I mean, he wrote them and somebody pulled it together. Can you remember the name of it? No, it's part of this book, though. It is. And it's called The Final Exam, and thank you for bringing it up. And I'm only repeating it so it makes it onto this recording, because you said it beautifully, but that, excuse me, Swamiji wrote about it. We usually pass it out at the end of this class, and I probably should have brought it tonight, along with that thing that was written by that young child at the end of Whispers. Very beautiful piece, but anyway. The Dying Youth Speaks, yeah. But this final exam where Swamiji is really saying to us, as Suman said, what matters is not, is that certainly throughout life that we're freeing ourselves. So he says, as she said, every night, just make a bonfire of all of the doubts and questions and negativity and whatever you can put into this fire. But certainly, as you get closer to your passing, to really practice. Because in the end, in the very end, how we die, it matters. It's a hard thing to say, because we've all watched some people not leave so well. And it's, of course, it's all karma. You know, that's what we're going to hear about next week, and what I was talking to Shringala about before, that the people in that room, when you had left your body, if they're really upset, it just registers in your astral spine. That's a true experience. It's a true, it's karma that you're going to carry. So we shouldn't hold this. I remember when my mother died. I'm going to finish that sentence that I didn't just finish. But when my mother died, it absolutely amazed me to see somebody die who was in their 70s, which at the time felt old to me. And I looked at her. I was with her right when she died. And I thought to myself, I don't think she learned one spiritual lesson in this life. I just could not imagine that. It did not look to me like my mother had made any spiritual progress. It was very, I don't say disheartening. It was holding me down. I was upset about it. She was gone, and I thought, did she just waste the whole incarnation? And I think I came home and I was talking to Asha about it. And very wisely, Asha said to me, no, the spiritual blessing in your mother's life is that she had you for a daughter. Not saying that I was anything so, anything more than who you know me to be, but that I was pursuing a spiritual path, that my heart and intention were in the right place, that everything I talked about, everything I read just about, I mean, my whole life is about spiritual growth. And what a blessing that was for her. That was actually very relieving for me. And I'm saying it because I wanted to finish the sentence that says, what's not just on our minds, but our words, our thoughts, where our heart is, where all of our energy is at the moment that we pass, really matters. It matters where we go in the astral world. Everybody just doesn't leave here and go to either heaven or hell. Heaven or hell. I mean, it's not what happens. There are many energetic levels almost. Again, they're called locus, but it really matters. People who are more highly spiritually evolved go to different places as they're waiting, or they're, you know, their resting place till they come back for their next life, for their next round of making spiritual progress. The masters say that you don't make much spiritual progress in the astral world because it's too beautiful, it's too easy, you're not challenged in any ways. And in the Raja Yoga teachings, Swami says many masters choose to come back, not avatars. Obviously, they only choose to come back if they come, but highly evolved souls and saints to a physical world and reality, because the suffering or what we need to go through here allows them to make much more spiritual progress than they can make in the astral world. But it shouldn't be so discouraging if somebody you know and love died and it doesn't look to you like they're making great progress. We don't know. When Asha said that to me, I knew instantly it was the truth. Yet in my mind, I was in pain about my mother, not because she left, but because I felt like she hadn't made any spiritual progress. We each have our own karma. Whatever it is that's on our astral spine, that's exactly what we're going to have to live out or have to deal with in this life in one way or another. We don't have to die with it, obviously. We're here to make progress. But we have to allow for people to leave when it's time for them to leave, in the way that they need to leave, and do our best just to hold the light. Somebody asked something before. I forget what the question was earlier, but I was thinking, I think, Maria, you were talking about what do we do for those souls. But even as they're leaving, as you know they're leaving, and make no mistake about it, it doesn't matter if you're really with them physically or not, it's good to be there. I think I would always choose to be near somebody that I cared about as they were leaving. But it doesn't mean if we're not that we can't be thinking about them, praying for them, holding an image of them in the light, opening our heart. It will help their soul. To the souls, there's no time and space. So it's not in the same physical reality that they're living. And people go on, and their lives are what they need them to be. There's that wonderful story from the Mahabharata. I'm going to tell a very short version of it. But there's a king, and he wants to marry a very beautiful woman, and she says, I'll only marry you if you never question anything I do, ever. And so he just wants her. He wants to have a son, somebody to hand the kingdom down to. So he says, okay. So finally she gets pregnant with their first child, and it turns out to be a beautiful little boy. And the child grows to be a few months old, and she takes him down to the river and drowns him. But he knows, the king knows, everybody thought she was crazy, that if he questions her, she'll leave. In the meantime, on the astral side, there are three souls who have had a curse put on them that they have to be reborn. They don't want to be reborn. And so their guardian angel says to them, I'll fix it so that you don't have to be on earth for very long. So I'm not going to tell the whole story. It goes on and on with three children. But you see, what looks like tragedy to us was a great blessing for those souls. So we don't really know. Our vision is so limited. That's what all these stories tell us. You know, when the woman comes in and says, I saw my daughter, she finally came to me, or I'm watching the soul of some man hovering on the ceiling in an ICU. You know, we're very limited in what we actually know, and we have to do our best spiritually every day and then trust about how and when people leave. But definitely, and I tell a lot of my friends this, and this is something I tell my partner all the time, because if people are inclined to complain or see what's wrong about things all the time, or then I always think, what if we're taken right then? You know, so these spiritual practices of keeping ourselves as uplifted and expansive as we can, whatever that means, but really with our heart and in the right place, our intention in the right place, it really matters. It matters a great deal more than we know because of this final exam that Swami wrote about. Well, this is why Master said we've all had millions of lifetimes and we don't remember it. And Krishna says to Arjuna in the Gita, you've had many lifetimes. I remember all of them. You remember none. I think, to be honest, there are people, or maybe people in this room, where people actually remember, you know, they have mindful experiences of a past life. And children, yeah. And here's the thing, is that children remember much more until they're somewhere around 4 to 5 years old. And then most children, and this has been studied and, you know, anyway, I have to finish a thought, but it's another very interesting story. But then very often they forget. not all the time, but they may not remember specifically that was my mother. But look, there's that movie about who was going to be the next Buddha, and they showed him, you know, you choose which of these things do you want, and he chose all of the things that belonged to him in the last life. So I think smaller children have a much better. But there are many adults. Somebody gave me a book recently about people who have written stories who know that they lived and died in the Holocaust during the Second World War. And there, I say that because Rwanda would be a Holocaust. There are many, but in the Second World War with the Germans and what went on there. But people who are now alive again or have been alive for decades who remember things that happened then, who will tell you stories there's no way they could have known, but they remember fragments. So some people really do remember. But I think most of us forget the vast majority of our lives. Let me put it that way. Master says it's God's grace because we've all done such difficult things. I mean, working our way to where we are now. But definitely, and we'll let Bhajana tell those stories. We have a family service here once a month, and it's actually gotten to be very strong. The kids come the first Saturday of every month. And this last Saturday, I was telling a story, and I always say to the kids, come on, gather around. It's precious. You know, 15 of them crawl up on your lap, and you read a story. This was a story about what makes you happy. And so everything that the book said, like, I feel happy when I do something nice for somebody. I feel happy when I'm with my family. I would throw it out so the kids could participate. And there was one little boy who kept talking about airplanes. Everything that made him happy had something to do. He was new. He'd never come before, but he looked to be about 6 maybe. And then I said to him, boy, you sure seem to love airplanes. Do you know a lot about them? He says to me, oh, I've known about them in all my lives. Just like that, you know, really interesting. And he knew. I mean, he had. Now, I've told a story in Sunday service. I think I told it in the distant past, but it's a big story that's out on the web about a little boy who was doing great till he was 2 years old. Then he started having all these nightmares. And this is a true story. And his parents were taking him everywhere to find out what was wrong. I'm shortening the story. It's fascinating. You can just Google little boy past life as an airplane pilot. Anyway, all he ever wanted to do was be around airplanes. And he knew from the minute he could say words, parts of airplanes that most adults would never know. And then they have videos that they would take him to the Aerospace Museum, and his mother would say something about, here, honey, come here under this part of the plane. He's 3. Go, Mom, that's not what it's called. And he would go in this huge discourse about the plane. And it was a very long story because the father was outraged when the mother-in-law suggested maybe it was something from a past life because they couldn't get him to sleep. He would have these horrible nightmares. And it turns out he was a World War II fighter pilot. And he was killed in his plane. And he started giving them all the names of people. They looked them up. They showed interviews. They were coming to this little 3- and 4-year-old and asking him, well, who was in the plane next to you? And he would give the name, and it was accurate. So, I mean, these things happen. I didn't want to get into it at family service and scare the families away. But, you know, I thought to myself, oh, my God, he's just saying, oh, I've known a lot about airplanes in all my lives. That's what he told me. So I think it happens. The other interesting point that you brought it up around animals because it's so obvious that we're making decisions. But, you know, we all get to make decisions like this, or many of us, in this life with human beings. And it's something that I have coached people through for years because I cannot tell you why, but somehow, I don't know, I just feel okay about making this decision about people. It comes, I don't know what else to say about it. It's never been, you know, my children say all the time, oh my God, I could never, they let their parents live on respirators and, you know, all kinds of life support for months and months and months. And they say, well, we don't know, we can't make that decision for them. Just exactly what you're talking about. And there's no one answer to say to you or to anybody, how do you get comfortable with it? But I do feel that the more we understand that, I mean, assuming we're being reasonable, we're not cutting off a human life or an animal life, I mean, too soon in an absurd way. But when, you know, animals are really sick and in pain and nearing the end of their life or suffering so much, and we don't really have that same option with human beings, but we do when they get near the end of their life, you know, to be able to say, we're not killing anything, just to hold that. We are really, literally, this is not just to make us feel good. We are allowing that soul to be free. And I think it's a whole different take on that that allows us to make those decisions more easily. I think it's horrible when people insist on breathing too long for people. And, you know, they have these things which most people have never seen, but they're like a machine that resuscitates from the outside. So it comes down and it just keeps pushing the heart. And I've seen people kept alive on those for over a month. So that literally it's robotic almost. That has nothing to do with the other person. That has to do with our incredible inability to let go and to let that soul soar, which is really what, I mean, when do we decide that's what's trying to happen? None of us are going to be in a position, we're not people who would actually cut off somebody's life too soon. We would much more err on the side of holding on to life for too long, I think. And our whole society does. You know, something like, close to 90% of healthcare dollars are spent in the last year of life. It's outrageous. I mean, we're talking billions and billions of dollars to keep people alive. It's pretty remarkable. Euthanasia, you mean? Yeah. Well, I mean, other people can comment on it. I, you know, because it's legal in so many states, and people have asked me, even here now, yeah. My sister asked me to help her leave, and I just can't do it. You know, I just can't. I'm totally comfortable with the idea of helping somebody leave. And if somebody has severe respiratory distress, particularly, for instance, morphine really helps. And, you know, there's a fine line. When have you given just enough morphine to help them breathe easier or to suppress respirations? And I've been there a lot of times, but I've always had to make a decision that was going to allow me to, you know, go to sleep that night. I mean, live with myself. It's complicated. But I wouldn't take somebody who's vibrant and alive. And it happened not that long ago in Oregon. I'm not passing judgment on it, but I'm only speaking for myself. I mean, I'd be interested to hear how other people feel, but She just got a diagnosis that they said they couldn't treat, and she went up to Oregon to be euthanized. And I feel like, you know, AIDS is a perfectly, we can't quite cure it, but people live a normal life now. We are curing so many diseases and conditions. Breast cancer is essentially a curable disease. I mean, in many, many, many people. You could just go on and on. I just, to me, it feels like, if we could help somebody awaken spiritually as they move towards that, to me, that's a much better way to go. Because you can even work with people and help them be so much less aware of pain and suffering while they're in their body. And, you know, God knows when it's time. I mean, as Ananda Moy Ma said, you know, when her disciples were going to her, wanting her to intervene in and around World War II, kept saying, Ma, you have to do something, you have to do something. She became very still one day, and she said, would you think that he who created all of this wouldn't know how to handle this war? It's like, this is in God's hands. Now, she was God, so she probably could have done something, but I think it was her way of saying, it's not mine to intervene. And I just feel that way. Lot with euthanasia. I can never be the one to do it. You know, people have a lot of way of leaving when they want to leave. My sister was one of them. I mentioned her before because we had such a very beautiful experience with her passing. I cannot think of how many deaths I've been present at. Many, many, many. But that was the most powerful experience because, again, we were just traveling together and it was so beautiful. But I'm convinced it was just her way of killing herself. She didn't actually kill herself, but life was so unbearable for her. That woman suffered from the minute she came in. Literally, she suffered. And I think she finally just like, I'm out of here. Give me cancer, give me, I always felt that, even when I was with her. So I was always grateful to her that she did it with cancer and not by suiciding because that would have been a lot harder. But yeah, I think we make choices. I remember my husband, Barry Rosen, not this current Barry, but the previous Barry. His father was this very powerful New York Jewish guy. And when he got a diagnosis of metastatic lung cancer, he was very controlling. I mean, very dictatorial, not a nice guy. But he looked at us all one day. He said, I'm not living with this. And he literally went to bed and died. Gone the next day. There was no reason for him to die. He just like, I am not going to live in need any one of you to give me anything. No way am I going to be dependent. I'm out of here. He left. And he did it out loud, but I feel like people, the soul does it. You know, it's like I've learned everything I can learn spiritually in this lifetime right now. It is time for me to go. I really felt like my sister just felt like she did not have it in her to make any more spiritual progress. And she left. And I think people, again, we're looking at it and evaluating it with our minds. If we could get in there and see from the soul's perspective what was going on, we'd hear a very different story a lot of the time. So, okay, anybody else? All right.